If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
I think you're either innately a really good recruiter or you're not. I think leveraging that plus the success I was having with building teams, with having fun, because work is hard work. Search is hard work. And if you're not having fun during that process, then why do it?
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today I'm joined by Leanne Howard.
The better relationship you have with the client and the longer term that relationship, they actually bring you in on their whole succession, their whole bench planning, and you know what's going to be happening.
Leanne is the founder and CEO of Howard & O'Brien, an award-winning retained executive search firm in Beechwood, Ohio.
We don't like turnover. We have a 98% success on our placements. We have a 99% success on actually doing our placements. We're retained, so we wouldn't be hired again if we weren't delivering. That's the one thing. So I'm going to pay you, and there's no guarantee I'm going to get a person. That's correct. You're paying me to consult on finding you a person.
Leanne has extensive experience recruiting CEO and other C-suite executive positions across various functions, including human resources, finance, sales, and marketing, in addition to key board of director members for both public and privately held companies.
Some boards don't have any age restrictions, but most of them will have an age restriction. And with some of the institutional shareholders, they're giving more about not just age, but length of service so that you don't become an insider.
Leanne, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Mark. I'm super excited about being here, and I followed you for a long time. So I never thought I'd be on this side of the microphone, having the opportunity to be interviewed by you because you're the best.
Thank you so much. That's kind of you. And I'm just so excited to learn from your experience. And we've had a conversation in the past, and I just know that listeners are going to really enjoy getting to meet you and learn from you. So I'm going to start with a question I ask almost all our guests, which is, how did you get into recruitment in the first place?
Well, it's probably not the typical way. My first career out of college was newscasting. And I loved it for a while, but I realized that it probably wasn't a career I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And a friend of our family worked for a company that, if you're from the United States, you might have heard of, called E.F. Hutton.
Oh, yes.
When E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. So a friend of our family, I went to talk to him about what I could do next. And he said, oh, you need to talk to this person. And so I talked to them, and it turns out her name was Nancy Chartino. She was over a company called the Davis Company, and I didn't know what the Davis Company did. This was before the internet. This was before you could find out that information very quickly. So I walked in. Turns out it was a search firm. It was a contingency search firm, and they had offices in a couple of different locations, but they would hire anybody with a pulse. I could interview. I'd won AP awards for interviewing, and next thing I know, I was working there.
That's so cool. And so what was it? Well, first of all, broadcasting seems more glamorous than recruiting. Why? And you've got a great voice, by the way.
You
speak with gravitas. So, but why did you want to leave broadcasting and try something different?
Well, the real reason was I knew that I was going to get old someday, and there were a number of women that were being fired from broadcasting because they were too old. And I thought, that is not a good career plan long term. So I can't avoid nature. So I didn't want to be dependent on someone else making a decision based on my skills. I wanted more control of my career. And I really felt like, while it was glamorous and everything else, I didn't know that it was something that I loved. I'd rather be behind the scenes making things happen than just being a talking head.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So you got into contingency recruiting without really knowing what you're getting into. What happened from there?
Well, I've always been super motivated and goal-oriented. And if we were supposed to make X number of calls a day, if we were supposed to have this many placements a week, then that was my goal. And within about 3 months, I was out producing the 10 other people in the division we had. So I was a moneymaker for our business. Jim Kendall came in one day, and there's something called the President's Club. And if you did really, really well, they came in with their tailor and then took you to a jeweler. And they did it in front of everybody else. So it was like this big deal. And they said, we'd like for you to come with. And I was like, I just was shocked, you know, that I would make President's Club. It's about a year into my business, my tenure there. And so I got tailored for two custom jackets, which are still in storage in my house. And occasionally I bring them out and put the cashmere winter one on with a big D on it, which was kind of cool. And then they gave you a necklace that was a diamond. And, you know, here you're in your 20s, you're pretty impressionable. But it turned out to be a really good search firm, especially a contingency search firm, because we brought in people like Disney to do goal setting and imagining what we could be as an organization. And I think that it wasn't just slash and burn. It was pretty high turnover, so you had to be able to produce, because we had 40 people on the team and 400 W-2s every year. Of those, that turnover, yeah, it was a big turnover. Of that turnover, I started volunteering to train all these people. And through that training, that led me to a corporate job.
Okay, interesting. I'd love to hear about that in a second. What sort of people were you placing in that first role?
Initially, they put all the women at the company into administrative secretarial.
Oh my God. It's so crazy to think how relatively recently that was. It's a different world.
It was. But I started getting some regular contracts, a lot of law firms, and I got some very, very good business connections. Plus, I was very involved in the community and had gotten into some leadership development programs and got visibility to CEOs and things like that. So they'd bring me in to help with their recruiting needs. And if I got really, really busy, I'd say to the client, well, you know, I'd love to work on you, but I've got all these other searches right now. And they said, well, what if I paid you? Which I didn't even know what containment was, or contingency, retingency at that point. And so they would pay me like a third up front, and then they'd pay me the remainder of it. So I had cash flow to be motivated to do the searches for them. And I didn't have to hunt quite as much because I had repeat client. And that theme is something that I've always believed in: service well, and the result should stick. Make sure the candidate is happy, make sure the client is happy, because then you'll get repeat business and repeat referrals too.
Absolutely. Repeat business and repeat referrals. That's 100%. So it's interesting that you almost stumbled into a sort of retained or at least engaged model, even while working at a contingent shop, which, and then latterly in your career, you've focused, you know, on the retained side of things. So that's super interesting.
But there's also one thing that, after I'd been doing that for a year and a half, and I saw how much more the guys were making on the other side, placing engineers and things, I said, why can't I go into that division? And they said, well, girls don't. I said, why? If I do half the business I do there, you're going to make three times the money because the fees are bigger. Why wouldn't you let me go do that? And of course, they were very motivated by fees. So I went in and did well in that division. And I didn't even know what a 6 degree of freedom model was for engineering. And I was placing people on Space Mountain and in highly technical, you know, security clearances and everything else. And I ended up getting investigated by the government because they thought I was a spy because I knew too much about. That was like,
I got visited
by the government. It was unbelievable because I'm sitting in my office and the receptionist comes back and they said, there's somebody here from the government to see you. And I'm like, I've paid my taxes, because that's the only thing I thought I could possibly do wrong. And I got taken into a conference room and they said, we believe that you know too much about what's going on. And I'm like, no, I'm not a spy. I don't work for Russia. You know?
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
You know, here you're 20 something years old and the government's investigating you and you're just like, no. But it was interesting, but they said, well, how do you know all this? And they started, I guess they recorded conversations back then, because there was a lot of spying and stuff. And they said, well, how do you know about? And I like, well, I asked the candidates that kind of. And so for me to understand more if they were qualified, I'd ask them and they tell me stories and I just pieced it all together. And they're like, well, you can't ask those kind of questions anymore. I'm like, I don't want to go to jail. You know? So,
wow.
But it really did make me realize that I was probably doing something right if I was getting information that other people weren't getting in my profession.
So. Yes. And so that's a sign of a good recruiter, right? Recruiters are curious slash nosy and are good at asking, you know, questions and following up and drilling down and really pulling information out of people. And you obviously just did too good a job with that. So are we talking about the FBI or what was this branch of the government?
It was like the Defense Security. What was it called? It was for National Security Agency, I think NSA.
Okay.
This has been a year or two. So
sure.
But I would have thought the FBI, because at that point I didn't realize there were all these other sub. It wasn't the CIA, I know, though. I think it was the National Security Agency, NSA, that came.
Yeah.
And after, wow. You know, once they realized I wasn't a spy and I was just this innocent little recruiter, I didn't get visited again. But of course, I was infamous in my office.
Absolutely.
The guys are like, oh, my God, we never got investigated. I'm like, well, you're not doing your job, you know?
Exactly. You're not asking good enough questions.
No. And it's and I remember Jim Kendall, our founder, came in and he said, well, that's a first. So and it's they made a big deal of it because we had celebrations and stuff. And so they gave me like, you know, a spy thing. And it just they made a lot of fun of it. You know how you do where you bring people together through collaboration and you recognize both the positives and negatives during that. And I do think that they did a really nice job of creating a fun environment, even with all that turnover. The people that were there were very supportive of each other, even though they were competitive. And people, you know, I know that one time we had a Rob Your Neighbor contest and Mrs. Kendall had bought all these. We didn't know what they were because they were just all wrapped up. And during the month of December, if you got a placement, you could go get a gift and then you could go seal some of these gifts. And it was one for everybody. And I literally have a picture of me in this red Christmas dress with a little muff halo out of fur on my hat, walking in with this huge smile with a stack of presents. And I'm sure everybody was mad at me because I took everybody's presents, but I got a walk. I still have the walk I got, you know, so I learned how to do walk cut and I got a laptop desk. Back then, yeah, you put on your lap and got just some weird stuff because she was very imaginative. But that was fun doing the Rob Your Neighbor contest. Of course, not probably for the people that didn't get any gifts. But
hell, you've got so many stories, Leanne. And there's a few different directions. I mean, I want to hear really about Howard and O'Brien. That's the main story, right? But one thing I wasn't expecting to talk about today is you literally broke the glass ceiling at that firm.
Yeah,
and yes. I wasn't... I mean, obviously, I'm being a white man. I'm perhaps oblivious to the kind of more subtle sexism that probably still happens. But in your case, it was very blatant, and like that is a surprise. But one, you mentioned that you got into the training, and then that led to a career in corporate. Tell me about you getting involved in training because,
Well, every morning there was a training session for people that came in and it started at 7 o'clock, which is pretty early when you're a 20-year-old and you're having fun at night and being active in the community. But I felt like they weren't doing a good job and we were spending all this time hiring people and then we were losing them. So I volunteered to come in and do the training 4 days a week. And, I didn't know what I was doing, but I figured I'll just take what they had in their training module and bring more information in so that maybe the person would have an easier start than say, hey, on the bus or on the phone or on the bus is what they used to say. And I just felt like we were throwing them into the wolves without giving them a proper introduction. Plus, I worried that people were out there calling in our territories that weren't very good. And then what happened to them? So it was more, how do we protect our brand? I didn't know at the time that's what I was doing, but it was more, how do we have better people that might stay longer, that might be more productive and had a more fulfilling career? We actually, during that time, we had someone call in dead. Seriously, her sister called on a Monday and said, well, my sister died over the weekend. And oh, it's like, oh my gosh, that's so terrible. So we looked on her application and found her preacher was one of her references. We called and we said, we'd like to send flowers to the funeral. And they're like, funeral? She was in church yesterday.
You know?
So,
oh my goodness.
I mean, it was a tough environment, but calling in dead, you know?
I've never heard that one. I've heard Colleen sick.
Yeah. Well, this is beyond sick. So we, of course, you know, that was, it was kind of funny looking back on it, but we were like, oh my gosh, we killed somebody. The work was so hard. You know, she's only there a couple works, but she didn't know how to say I quit. And so she decided to have her sister do it for her. So,
goodness.
But the training and development really was something that I felt like it was, and I've always been curious. And you mentioned earlier that we're nosy and curious. And I think that lifelong learning is important and understanding and being able to ask those questions. Plus, you learn from the people you're training as much as you're giving them information. If you give them a chance to talk and share their stories and share their experiences, it's as every day, we'd review what they did the day before, what they learned from that. And so it was a learning lab is what we end up creating.
I was going to ask you how you have volunteered to do the training, but what was the benefit to you? How do you feel that that helped with your own development?
Again, I think that you ended up having colleagues and you could collaborate on things because they trusted you that you weren't going to stab them in the back. And unfortunately, in a lot of search firms, it's all about the fees and about my share of the fees. And I've always believed this, that if you do the right thing, that the money will follow. And I felt like they felt I would help them. I would, like, if they were having Robinson on a call or anything like that, even during the day, you know, I would help them. And it took me away from what I was doing, but I also knew that they'd have my back, I felt like. And, you know, people, when we took them to the training, we didn't have as many people turning over during that period of time. And luckily enough that I didn't know that would be the foundation for my first corporate job.
That is cool. And look, as a trainer myself, I know that you actually learn your subject even better by teaching it, right? Because you have to know your stuff and you'll have to organize it in your head. Because like when you took off like a rocket and joined President's Club in the first year, you were just doing, you probably weren't analyzing, why am I at the top, you know, of this firm? But then if you're trying to teach someone else, you have to reflect and analyze and think, what, break this down. Why am I able to produce this level of results? And how could I show somebody else those principles so that they could replicate that success? And so by teaching it, it really forces you to consolidate your own skill set, if that makes sense.
You internalize it, Mark. And what happens, it becomes more and more a part of who you are. Even today, I'll read interview books. And we were at an event last night. I still do a lot of volunteer work at the American Heart Association. And they were talking about quantum computing. And my son, which we'll talk about later, happened to be with me. And I said, hey, I have a book back on my bookshelf about quantum leadership. And he's like, Mom, what don't you have on those bookshelves? And unfortunately, that's true. But when I was in HR and R&D, we brought in a woman that wrote the book on quantum leadership. And it showed how quantum physics can be replicated in leadership and the patterns of leadership that you can look back to quantum physics. So it was kind of interesting seeing a quantum, literally at the Cleveland Clinic, we saw a quantum, IBM quantum computing machine. That was, wow. I mean, how often do you get to see those kind of things?
Absolutely.
But I think that's where, just because it's not just you as a recruiter, too many people are only focused on their craft, but that parallel learning that Edward De Bono, I don't know if you know him or not, six creative thinking hats, he talks about sometimes being in a different lane of parallel thinking, all of a sudden you can relate it back to where you might have a sticky problem or something like that. And thinking about that last night of the scientists and learning what they're doing on heart disease and what they're doing to help people with heart failure. And it was listening to these young investigators that the dollars from the Heart Association made a difference in their lives and their careers. And hopefully 30 years from now, people will be able to be alive and enjoying their families because of it. So that's exciting. So it's beyond the research. It's beyond search. It's a full life that you end up creating.
Exactly. I'd like to circle back to that, but you're not going to believe this, Leanne. The lady who wrote the book on quantum leadership is my aunt.
No way.
Yeah. Donna Zohar, right?
No way. That's your aunt?
Yeah.
What are the chances?
I know.
What are the chances?
Now, she is
fascinating.
A very interesting lady because she's American, but she lives in London. well, not London, but Oxfordshire. And she married my dad's brother, and who's now passed. But she is a very intelligent, but also quite eccentric lady. And she's still lecturing and writing. I don't know what age she is. She must be, you know, late. She must be about 90, I reckon, late 80s at least.
That's and, amazing.
But
what are the chances?
I know. That's hilarious.
But what you've just demonstrated is the connections that we all have. And probably what I love most about recruiting is that 6 degree of separation, that Kevin Bacon
sure.
movie. It really is about asking that next question and then connecting those dots. And a good recruiter is that curious and that nosiness, but then they can also say, oh my gosh, I have a connection there. And that's where the bond starts to build between a candidate, between a client. It's not just, okay, well, I'm going to ask you the next question. And you're really trying to develop a rapport so that you get an understanding of what the client needs, but also what the candidate needs. So you can match that together. That's wild. Well, tell her I still quote the book. I've got literally two copies on my bookshelf, on my active bookshelf. So that's crazy.
Let's jump forward to your corporate career. So how did recruiting lead you to corporate and then lead you back into executive search?
As I said, my training and development experience, I was very active in the community, and I met a woman who was in marketing at Peabody Coal, which is the coal company in St. Louis where I was living. And I said something about, I was really tired because I'd worked the East Coast at 7 o'clock, you know, you start at the East Coast and you work the West Coast till 10 o'clock Midwestern time. And I was tired. So I'd happened to have an extremely bad day, I guess. And I said, I'm just exhausted. And I said, how did you get into work with what you're doing? She goes, well, I started in training and development. And she started describing it. I'm like, I could do that. I would so want to do that. Not thinking it would go anywhere, you know, just as a comment. She calls me later that day and said, hey, my boss, Tom, wants to talk to you. And you know the CEO, Wayne, he met you through the leadership program that Coral had. And I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. And it was interesting because I decided, okay, I'll go talk to them. You know, it might be another new client or something. And I ended up really, really liking Tom a lot. He turned out to be a really good mentor. And so I remember I didn't want to tell him how much money I made, because I'm sure it was going to be paying a lot less than recruiting. And at one point, they finally asked me, and I said, well, make me a fair offer, you know, because we had all these things. They said, well, what are you making? I said, well, I make $450,000. And there's just a silence. And I like, well, this job pays $40,500. I said, great, I'll take it. Because I knew it wasn't the money that, again, that motivated me. It was making a difference. And I knew if I stayed where I was, my lifestyle would catch up with my income. And that wasn't important to me. I saved all my money. I had enough money to buy a house, buy a car, you know, because I didn't, you know, the government was taking half of it. And I didn't really have an extravagant lifestyle, which I still don't have today. So I've just always, you know, thought of it. And that was probably a lot of people wouldn't have done that. But I felt like it would round out my knowledge base and my career, and it did. So from there, I went to Frito, which was an amazing place to be in HR. I got lucky. I worked for an entrepreneur named Ewing Kaufman with Marion Labs, and he started the Kaufman Foundation for Entrepreneurship. So I really got a great example of how someone could be entrepreneurial and go beyond just working for themselves to building a company that was very successful. And then at DuPont was where I met your aunt and the quantum physics. I headed up R&D, HR, and worked with scientists. And then I got hired by Nestle. And I loved my job at Nestle, but I was finally got married. I waited a long time to get married, and I had my first child. And I was breastfeeding in Milano, and the equipment didn't work. So I'm like, as I'm sitting there in a car with a breast pump, you probably haven't had that on your ears as well. I realized that, yeah, my life had changed. But as much as I love my job at Nestle, because I had responsibility for 22 sites worldwide, I was now a mom, and I loved my family and my child, and I wanted to be there. So I'd been a guy that was very, very good in HR, probably the top HR recruiter had talked to me a couple times about joining him. And I came back and I said, maybe this is the time to do it. Because I always thought I'd go back and search. When I left, I said, oh, when I'm old, I'll go back and search. And almost, you know, don't say things, because that self-fulfilling prophecy ended up happening almost the time that I said I'd go back to search. I'll go back when I'm 40. And that's what I did, was went back when I was 40.
Wow. So I'm still can't quite get over you took a 90% pay cut. But ultimately, that corporate experience, the what you learned, the people you met, how did that set the stage for you to step into retained executive recruiting later on?
I think because I knew enough about recruiting, having been in contingency and done kind of the first level of leadership and then doing technical engineering as well as the admin, I think that that leveraging plus the training and development piece of it, you ended up, I just kept moving into different parts of HR and becoming a generalist and a organizational development specialist. But it came naturally to me. And again, that curiosity, I always had that recruiting edge to me, and I would work in recruiting sometimes. And even if I wasn't recruiting, people would want me to interview the final candidate. And I'd say something and they're like, you spent 25 minutes with them. How did you get that? I'm like, I ask them questions. And I said, they're not the right candidate. They're like, how do you do this? And I think you're either innately a really good recruiter or you're not. And it was just, I think, leveraging that plus the success I was having with building teams, with having fun, because work is hard work. Search is hard work. And if you're not having fun during that process, then why do it? And the results follow, I think, as a result of that. But moving over, I knew what I was getting into. I knew the mentality of working hard, always making that last call before you leave, always doing that last email. That's where a lot of recruiters, oh, it's five, I'm out of here. This is not a 9-to-5 job. And you're always on, and you never know when you're going to meet somebody. I'm not a salesperson naturally. It's more I'm a relationship person. And I think that's what's built the business so easily. And I love my candidates and my clients. And I can still remember when I run into somebody I placed 15 years ago, we have annual calls with people on their anniversaries as a way to stay in touch.
That's a good idea.
And it is a good idea. And it's funny because a lot of times you know them well enough, you sing happy anniversary to them. And not that I'm a great singer, but it's kind of a fun thing. And I'll call, I said, hey, is your dad still cutting your hair? Because his dad was a barber when he was growing up. And his first job was cleaning up the hair in the barbershop, you know, sweeping the floors. So he's like, I can't believe you remember this. But I always try to remember something about someone that makes them unique. And I just like that part of my job is that personal contact that you get and those relationships that you build.
You've given so many little sprinkles of gold dust there already, Leanne, and really interesting to learn how you think and how you operate. And I can see why you've had the longevity and the success that you have. Let's talk more about Howard & O'Brien then, because you're a boutique firm. You work senior level cross-functionally. And do you recruit mainly in Ohio or is it national?
We're national. We do some international. Currently, we're doing a CEO search in Toronto for one of our long-standing clients. And someone from that board, which is, I mentioned yesterday, you know, I was talking to somebody who said, well, how did you end up in McAllen, Texas, doing a search for a Mexican operation? I said, because somebody on that board, who I've known for probably 20 years, called and said, I think you'd be right for this family. And it's one of their portfolio companies. So we do work outside of the area, and people take us with us. We don't necessarily go call on Toronto or McAllen, Texas, but because of those relationships and those past successes, I think that the people bring us with us.
So let's dive into that, because something that you are very successful at, which we've never really explored on the show before, is the idea of putting boards together. And that's kind of one of your specialties. Could you share, how did you get into that and tell us a little bit about that world?
Well, if you remember, you said that, you know, breaking the glass ceiling at my first firm. And when I moved to Cleveland from the New York Stanford office of the larger firm, one of my colleagues had an account with a very large multinational global company that he'd done some work for before. And he said, hey, you need to come along because they want a woman for this board role. So I went along and as the token female on that team, and we ended up doing very well on that search. That's the company that I ended up when I left. It's kind of funny because when I left and started my own firm 3.5 years later, I got a call from the head of HR and he said, hey, we want you to do another board search. And I'm like, great. He'd like to come meet in your offices. I'm like, great. He can come to our international global conference room, which is my dining room. Because at that point, I worked out of my house. And there was a pause from the admin. And she said, let me get back with you. So she calls back the next day and said, how about you come to our offices? And that led to us doing about 8 to 10 searches on the board for over the next 20 years, basically.
Wow, that's cool. So how does board recruiting work then?
Okay. Board recruiting, it's in some ways it's harder, in some ways it's easier because you've got a very demanding client because they are CEOs and they're used to, and board chairs that they're used to, governance chairs, they're used to, you know, people adhering to their timeframes and everything else. But there's a natural occurrence where you might get the search during one board cycle, and then you do a slate presentation at the next board meeting a quarter later, and then they make the decision. So it's usually a 4 to 6 month period of time. And during that time, you're putting together a slate, but you're calling people and you're not taking them away from something. You're adding something to their lives and to their schedule. And it's interesting because a lot of people, they'll think, how can I add anything else? I'm already a busy executive. But I think that those that are looking for a board or thinking about a board, you might call them at just the right time. And you're very targeted about what you're looking for. So the client that I mentioned that we've done all those searches for, I've worked for 3 different CEOs during the tenure there. And maybe working for my 4th CEO, you know, if they have another board opportunity, but they're pretty boarded up right now. But he only wanted sitting CEOs. Well, that's what everybody wants, is sitting CEOs, because they're active, they're engaged. And somehow we delivered for him more sitting CEOs, even at bigger companies, that would make no sense. Because you can always, if you're CEO, you can get on a bigger company board. And we started doing what I would call pre-recruiting and scouting. So we knew kind of what, we had a 5-year plan of what their board needed to look like. And we'd worked on the strategy around that, about the skills they needed, the background, the industries, those types of things. And then we started doing the research to find people that would fit that criteria. And in 3 cases, we had people that were sitting CEOs that weren't active on a board yet outside of their own board, and they weren't ready to go on a board. So we started courting them and having conversations with them. And in one case, it was someone that frequently came to Cleveland because their largest client was the Cleveland clinic. And so I said, hey, next time you're down at the clinic, how about we get you together for dinner with the CEO and some of the officers over there? Well, that led to, you know, 3-4 years later, when he was finally ready to say, I'm ready for the outside, I've got my job under control. He ended up joining that board, even though the board wanted him to go to a different, you know, bigger company and everything else. And he's amazing. He's just done very, very well. He's been a great addition. And I think, those are the types of relationships that you have with your clients over time. We're just starting a board search for another client that we did 8 years ago. We did a board search and now they need another outside board member. And that's a privately held company. And those are the types of things that the board recruiting, it's different in many ways because you're not taking somebody away. It's adding to their schedule. But I think at the same time, it's a prestigious type of opportunity. If you think about board service, and it's not like you go in and can leave after 3 or 4 years, it's a commitment beyond that. Most board members are on there for significant periods of time. And even if they have annual voting in, if they're doing a good job, they're going to continue to be voted in.
So this is fascinating. It's an area I don't know much about. And so I have so many questions. One being, who is the actual client? Like, who appoints your firm to find outside board members? Because is it the chairman of the board? Is it the CEO? Is it somebody else? How does that work?
It could be all of the above. For instance, right now we have been engaged by the head of the Nominating and Governance Committee. So every committee has different responsibilities on the board. And on that particular one, it's the nomination committee that's in charge of that. But they also, before they make that decision, the rest of the board is basically gets a vote to say, hey, is it okay if we engage such and such? Most of the time, just so that they're notified, there's no surprises. And the CEO will know. Other times, the CEO calls us and said, hey, I need to work on this. One of our clients, they knew that they would have 5 retiring board members over a period of time because they age out. There's age limitations that could be usually in the United States, it's between 70, 72, 75. Some boards don't have any age restrictions, but most of them will have an age restriction. And with some of the institutional shareholders, they're giving more about not just age, but length of service so that you don't become an insider. So there's all types of things that go along with that. But once they engage, then you agree on what your target is. So you, in many cases, we'll talk to all the board members. We'll talk to the leadership team about what they'd like to see in the board. You're getting a feel for culture because it's a very collegial environment on a board, but you have to be able to also have a voice. And no matter what your title is, you each have an equal vote. And I think that a lot of times, you know, there might be somebody that's from a $20 billion company and there's somebody from a $1 billion company on that board. Doesn't matter. You're all bringing value. And the better run boards will value everybody's opinion. You may have a lead director, you may have a chair of the board. Again, it depends on the structure of that corporation. But what you're really trying to do is bring in somebody that's going to complement what they have, but also give them additional information. Right now, for instance, cyber and IT are very, very popular because every company ends up being an IT company. And it's not necessarily, if you can hire it from the outside, do you really need it on your board? So can you hire a consultant? But if it's somebody that's done a digital transformation or has done something around taking a completely different platform as a leader from a line standpoint, that might be the type of person you're looking for. Right now, there's a lot of focus on getting people from San Francisco and the Silicon Valley area because of the technology that has just taken off. AI is huge right now. Machine learning is huge. Everybody's trying to figure out what it's going to be and how it's going to impact their business. So again, if it's something, the skill that can have a long-term need on your board, that's how you make that decision.
Fascinating. It sounds like a lot of work. How do you charge for this? Because normally, you would charge a percentage of the package. But in this case, it's like it's only a part-time role. But it sounds like the effort to fill that seat is just as much as a normal placement.
It is. It's equal to what you would do for a regular executive level placement. And there's more than one way to place it, depending on the organization. A lot of people will basically take what they pay annually to their person and look at what that would be. That could be based on the fee. It could be the actual director's fees. It could be also based on the number of hours you anticipate that person, how much that executive is worth. So let's say, you know, they range from anywhere from $100,000 to $150,000 for fees. And a lot of times depends on the size of the company and the complexity of the search that you're looking for.
So $100,000 to $150,000 in fees to the recruiter?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, fantastic. And it also sounds very like strategic and forward planning. A lot of recruiting is reactive, right? Someone resigned, we have to fill that seat. But with this, it sounds like you mentioned you're doing a planning exercise where you're looking at what they want their board to look like in 5 years. That's unheard of in normal kind of day-to-day recruiting.
It can be. It is kind of reactive, but you're also planning. We're doing a CFO succession right now.
Okay.
And the CFO has announced that he will be transitioning, but they want someone to come in that will be able to cross-train and then go into it. So there's planning for that, but at the same time, it's not just, oh my gosh, he's gone now, let's go look, which happens a lot. But if you're the better relationship you have with the client and the longer term that relationship, they actually bring you in on their whole succession, their whole bench planning. And you know what's going to be happening. We've had clients that we've had even before I started my business. We have a client right now that we've worked with for 12 or 15 years, and we've seen them go through bankruptcy, through private equity, through going public again. I mean, it's been a roller coaster, but the one thing we tell candidates, there are no jerks in this team. And people that have been there through all that riding through it, they're like, this is the best team I work with, because they're all in there together. They're all collaborating. They're all making a difference. So you can plan that. You know what's going to happen a lot of times within that organization. And you also know who's going to fit there culturally. And that's a really big part of what we work on, is who's going to be a match for them and is going to enjoy working there and be committed to working there. We don't like turnover. We have a 98% success on our placements, and we have a 99% success on actually doing our placements. And we're retained, so we wouldn't be hired again if we weren't delivering. And that's the one thing. So I'm going to pay you, and there's no guarantee I'm going to get a person. That's correct. You're paying me to consult on finding you a person.
Okay, I love it. And so we're going to talk about relationships in a second. I have one more, because what the depth of relationship you're describing is, I think, what many good recruiters would aspire to, but very few actually get to experience. So I'd love to learn more about how you have cultivated that over the years. But first, you mentioned that when you're putting boards together, there's some things that are easier and some things that are harder. You mentioned one of the easier things is that you're not actually taking them out of a situation. You're just adding to their, you know, schedule, their experience. What's one of the things that's harder about it?
You're asking a person to take on more responsibility. It's 300 to 400 hours of time on top of their regular schedule. And you've got to convince them that they're doing it. Plus, you've got to say no to the only one person, like any other search, only one person gets it. Mm-hmm. And these are very powerful people that if you don't treat them well during this process, they could not be happy with you.
Right.
So I think how you treat people through that process on any search is important. But this one is, they are making decisions about who is going to be hired. In a lot of cases, do all their searches. And it's, if you're doing it right, you're building a relationship that they bring you in to do more than just a board search. And they become a client as well. So yes. I think that's probably one of the things is, there's nuances to it. There's a professionalism that it's not transactional at all. It's really building that relationship. And we've got a 100% success on our board searches. And everybody, we only had our first retirement that aged out. So everybody stays there a long time over the 24 years I've been doing this. They've stayed, and that has led to other work as well. The other thing is, you talked to, one of the things I wanted to mention too is the development side of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people aren't getting the calls to go on boards. And so we started years ago something called Conversation with the Board to try to bring more women into boards, because I would call and I'd ask somebody, hey, what do you think? Who do you know? They name everybody else. I said, well, what about you? Oh, I could never be on a board. And you're like, you're a CFO of a, you know, $18 billion company. You could be on a board. So I started doing a program called Conversation with the Board to have more women exposed. And this is back in 99. And now it's becoming very popular to have more diversity on a board. But back then it wasn't as much. And I think that that program has led to other things. We do reverse placement also, which is where it's paid for by the company or the candidate. Because you can do all this training when you're an executive. You can get your master's degree. You can go to the Harvard or Wharton or Kellogg program on executive leadership. You can have a coach. You can do all these other things. But there's a point where you kind of train out of what the development is. And if you're able to get on a board, you've got the opinion of 8 to 10 other very senior leaders with different industries, different challenges that you're working with, as well as the company you're serving on the board of. That's a learning lab that every quarter you're getting exposure to, and you're building relationships on a very deep basis that you can use as colleagues to bounce stuff off of. For instance, during COVID, one of the people we placed on a board happened to be in charge of the business roundtable, which is most of the major businesses here in the United States are a member of this. And he was making the decision along with one other leader of a very big national hotel chain. What's the COVID policy going to be? What are we recommending? Now, if you had to rely on figuring that out yourself, instead, you've got all these resources. If you're having trouble right now, one of the things that's happening is the tariff risk plan that people are looking at because of the anticipated change in the administration. So people are talking about tariff risk. Well, is there a place that you can go, other colleagues that are facing the exact same type of challenges? So that's the one thing we found with our reverse placement is it's an opportunity to round out and provide ongoing development for your leaders. And that's been a very successful part of the business as well.
I have so many questions. I feel like I'm getting an MBA here in recruiting.
No, you're not getting an MBA in recruiting. But...
And so
we'll work on the PhD the next time.
All right. Okay. Fantastic. So the conversations with the board, am I remembering that? Conversations
yes,
with the board?
You're correct.
And that's a really cool concept. Is that continuing or what does that look like in the current business?
We just had one about 8 weeks ago now. And it was one of the people that we actually placed on a board who just became lead director of that board. And so we had taken him out to celebrate his appointment after 5 years on the board of becoming lead director. And I asked him again at that time, would you do this session for us? Ironically, during that session, one of the women who was the controller of a very large multinational company, I talked to her about another search I was doing for a business development head for a wealth management company. And she goes, oh, my sister. And guess what? Guess who the final candidate who's going to be hired is? Her sister. So
amazing.
This is where that serendipity of recruiting, everybody always wants to know what you're working on. They always want to know what you're doing. And in that case, that group of people that were there, they've already, many of them have fallen up with the speaker and building a relationship with him, but they followed up with each other too. And again, that's where that ongoing learning comes in. And conversation with the board, it was more developed with a woman in legal who wasn't a competitor and a woman in public relations that I said, let's do this together because I was new to town. I didn't know that many people. I moved there 6 months before, but that really was also a catalyst for getting more women to be considering and potentially going on boards as well.
Could you say more about how this program actually works, how it's delivered? And because I still don't fully understand what it entails.
It's very, what the initial idea and what most of the sessions are, is we bring a chairman or a CEO in. They have a 2-hour time frame. It's usually over a meal in the company's boardroom so they can showcase the organization. And what we do is, you know, you're eating, but you're also then, we ask for questions ahead of time that we submit to the person. And it could be anything from, what's the best way to get considered for a board? What should I do about a board bio? And then we also give a chance of the introduction part is asking any questions that they might have at the same time. So one of the best questions we got was from a woman who said, well, why would I even want to be on a board? And I think it surprised he said, well, that's a really good question. You know, let me tell you what I find the benefit to it. But what you're really trying to do is we would do it in a confidential. It's what is that cider house rules where what stays here, like in Vegas stays, that people don't go out and talk about what was said in that meeting. And so there's a trust
charter
that's
house
developed.
Rules, I think
charter house rules. So what really happens is that you get this honest, open dialogue within the group of people. And a lot of times we've had them come back and repeat the experience where they said, I want to come do this again. So we've had repeat experiences from our speakers, and then we have to divide it up again. And sometimes we'll have somebody come back as a second time guest and everything. But what you're really trying to do is give them a chance to start thinking about what they need to do to prepare for a board. And if they go on a board, how should you behave? So one of the best things I always say is Abraham Lincoln quote is it's better to be thought a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt.
I love that quote. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. My brother used to tell it to me, you know, so it's interesting because I will tell people you got on the board, you've already been invited to the party. Don't make them regret the decision to invite you. So learn the board, understand it, understand the chemistry, take the time, and then contribute with wisdom.
I like it. That makes total sense. So, Leanne, this is a in-person event, and how often does it happen?
We do it. Our goal is to do it 4 times a year.
Okay, fantastic. And is it specifically for women? to who wanted to progress to board
appointments? At this stage, it's still for women. It's still for women. Okay. We get a lot of pushback. Guys are like, how come I can't be part of it? I said, because you still have the majority of placements on board.
Exactly. Yeah, that's understandable.
And then the reverse placement is open to anybody. Yeah, it's open to anybody. Placement,
what does that involve?
It's basically where you would be engaged on behalf of a candidate, either by the corporation that's investing in their development, most likely is probably what it is. And you would come together and you would help them with their board bio. You'd understand why a board, what type of industry, where their skills are transferable. And then you'd put together a marketing plan of the most reasonable and likely places that would be interested. In addition, you're doing research about those individuals. You're doing research to say, are there upcoming boards in industries or companies that this person would align naturally to? So you're doing not only where would you want to go, and then you're also managing expectations. Hey, that's great. You want to be on Amazon's board? Probably not going to happen. So you're really helping them look at a realistic view. You're helping them with how would they present themselves in interview and taking it to the next level so that you put them in front. It ends up, if I'm a board that happens to have an opening and all of a sudden I get Mark Whitby's, oh my gosh, I would love to have him on my board. And basically that's how the dialogue starts.
So it sounds, I guess, similar to an MPC campaign where you have a candidate that you're introducing to companies, but you mentioned that it is this process. So if you place someone on a board, is it the company who pays you or it's the...
On the reverse placement, which is director connector, basically you're retained by the client or the candidate, or generally their company will retain you to go help find the place to put them on.
Okay, interesting. So their company wants them to do an outside board appointment in order to develop them so that they bring more to their main job.
Exactly. And a lot of times they're a successor to, it could be the next level down where they're a successor to an officer level job. And that's where you have to be realistic that you're probably, if you're not already at like the CEO title or the CFO title, you may not get a company as big as you are. So managing their expectations as well.
Got it. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Wow, that's fascinating. And so, Leanne, let's talk about the relationship piece. And then I'd love to talk about your succession plan as well, because this is an issue for many, many smaller recruiting firms when, you know, you're reaching an age where you might want to take a step back or not work as much, but you don't want the company to just disappear, which you've put so much into over 23 years. But before we get into that, you're describing client relationships, which many listeners will be envious of, where, you know, it's very long term. You're involved in succession planning. You're involved in, you know, it's that much more strategic part of recruiting. How do you get yourself into the position of companies trusting you to provide that to them?
Well, I think, Mark, that too many recruiters are interested in the transaction, the sale.
Sure.
And we believe that if you build a relationship, it may not happen initially, but if you're providing the value, you might be sending out information that might be relevant to them. There may be an article that you think a person may want to know about. So I think those are the types of things that too many recruiters don't step back. 20% of my job is always doing some type of business development activity. And always thinking about how do I position the business for the future? And those relationships is really, really where the future is. So there was one time for our 10th anniversary, we brought in, was it 5th or 10th anniversary? We brought in Ram Shriram, which was this huge, you know, like every Fortune 500 company had brought him in to do consulting. And we brought him in to basically celebrate our 5-year anniversary. We happened to have a relationship with them, and nobody could believe that we had Ram Shriram. And they're like, how did you get Ram Shriram to come to like 40 people that we invited, clients, as well as potential clients that we've been potentially developing? And I just shrugged my shoulders because I don't know how we did it. But the cachet of having Ram Shriram come was pretty amazing. And there was one person that we'd been calling on for some time. And he calls like a couple weeks later, he goes, well, all that 7 years of working on me, I finally have a search for you. And I said, wow, what was the tipping point? He goes, you invited me to Ram Shriram. So I think you've got to look at it as a long-term investment. Also, a lot of our work is because we're good corporate stewards. I'd say everybody on my team is involved with some type of community activity. And so we're seeing we're doing good in the community because we believe in our community and we believe in providing insights to where we are. So I think that's really helped is we're not just, you know, looking for what's out for us. It's more, what can we do to help? And that comes back to us in many, many ways. So I think it's the relationship, it's the follow-up, it's the thank you notes, it's the handwritten notes. It's the things that were a lot easier to do before COVID because now we don't know where to send anything.
Right.
So we used to do annual gifts where we were very creative gifts. One year we sent out two kinds of olive oil, zesty and tangy. And we had people writing saying, well, I did a taste test and this is my favorite one. And we sent out cherry salsa one year. And one of our, I guess somehow it got broken in shipping. So the person had just done a massive layoff and said, I was really worried that somebody had sent me a body part because salsa, you can imagine salsa was
sauce
like red
leaky fruit. Oh my gosh.
Exactly. And it was, and so we have a lot of stories just by, you know, that was a thing we did every year was sending out and we did handwritten notes on every single one of those gifts that went out. Most people wouldn't have done that.
It's a lot of effort and it's you're
yeah.
So what do you do? Do you still do the handwritten notes?
I do them, but not as much, but I wish I did more of them because our address on them because we still had our old address when we finally got out of corporate offices and I had run out of them. So somebody literally just sent me a gift, said, I'm paying it forward. I'm sending you thank you notes.
Nice.
I'm like, so I'm kind of guilted into it. I just opened that last night. I'm like guilted into it. I better start doing it again. It was a good reminder, though, at the same time. So I think that it's, if not an email, but how do you differentiate yourself from the competition?
Yes.
What makes you different is what you're trying to do. And I think it's the little things. There was a marketing person that I was interviewing for a job, and she knew I'd just gotten a new puppy. And she sent me this little assortment of stuff for my puppy. Now, I still remember that because,
absolutely.
I mean, she listened to what I was saying. It, you know, she probably spent $20 on it, but what an impact. So when people tell you, you know, if I got you something from if I had a connection to the Rock Hall, I'd send Daniel something from the Rock Hall. You know, that would be my way to thank you for the time we spent today. So think about how you stand out and what makes you different. And I think the other thing is, you know, we talk about the team. I'm super, super lucky. I have a lot of long tenured employees. And even the people that may not have been here as long, they've been referred by people within the firm. So my marketing person is a neighbor to my document prep person. So Rachel and Jennifer have known each other for like ever. And she said, I do know somebody for this job, you know? So those are the types of things that you always ask those closest to you, but you also tell people what's going on and you want to be helpful. If it's not for search, you know, helping them get introduced to a plumber. I mean, something as simple as that may make a difference and they'll remember, oh my gosh, I've got the best plumber because of you. So I think that's part of it is putting yourself second and putting others first.
Amazing. So tell me how your son has joined you in the business and I'd love to hear that story.
Okay. Well, I have two children and they were very young when I started the business. My son is 27, and my daughter's 26. And so they were, what, 2 and 3 or 3 and 4? And so they literally grew up listening to phone calls and being a part of it. And my son was in the Army. And my daughter has a cool job. She works as a mechanical engineer on the Empire State Building for a consulting firm out of the UK. So, I mean, they have really super jobs. My son was a captain in the military, and he started thinking about, he thought he'd be career Army. And he'd gone through ROTC and everything. And about a year ago, year and a half ago, he said, hey, I'm thinking about getting out of the Army. What would you think of me joining the family business? I was shocked because I didn't think that was a possibility. And I said, wow, let me think about it. So I thought about it for a day or two and I came back. I said, I'm okay with it, but you've got to interview with everybody on the team, which is the way we hire people. Everybody has to talk to everybody. And I said, because they remember you, you know, some of them have been around since you were 5 years old. So they remember when, you know, used to be part of the gift crew that put together all those gifts and notes that we sent out. So they've known you as, you know, a kid and growing up through high school and college and everything. And so he interviewed with everybody. He did an internship through a program called Hiring Our Heroes, which is for servicemen that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does. And so it gave him 3 months of actually shadowing 4 days a week our team and getting exposure to us. And then he joined us full time in May. And I said, listen, take 2 years. This is not a job that you come in and you love it immediately. It's a lot of hard work. And it's, and I tell clients sometimes it's search, not fetch for a reason, because you're really out there looking for the person. It's not just, you know, one of my clients told me years ago, posting and praying that somebody good would come. You're searching for that right candidate. And there's a lot of research, a lot of behind the scenes, there's a lot of connections and follow-up. And so I want to make sure you love this job because it is an avocation as well as a vocation. So he's in the process of figuring that out. And I'm super proud of him because he's following the legacy. He's involved with the Heart Association because he's been doing it since he was a little kid, volunteering for them and interning for them. And he just got named to a national Leaders Council and was the inaugural chair of that board for the Heart Association.
Oh, fantastic. So good for
him. I'm like, yes, the legacy is continuing. So my work here is done. So, but it's his decision. And you're right. It's the hardest thing for any small business is knowing how to do succession. I don't want to just abandon my clients. I've been with them for so many years. I've got next generations in there. I just don't want to someday, hey, my lights are out. And so you either, you have two choices, three choices. You turn off the lights, you find a successor, or you find a strategic buyer. And those are your three choices when you have a small business.
Leanne, this has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed learning from you today and your wisdom and insight. So thank you very much for being
welcome
on the show.
I've had a great time. So, and let me know if you want to work on that PhD next.
Yes, sign me up. Let's do part two.
All right. And maybe the next time I'm in Ireland, I'll get it over to where you are and we will be able to get together.
I'm in Scotland, but...
I know. So I'll have to come up to Glasgow.
So you're coming to Ireland to... Because you have family connections here, right?
And, So then we would just have to just pop up to Edinburgh or Glasgow or something.
Yeah.
So
I'd love to. That would be super fun.
Or in Florida at one of your upcoming conferences too.
Either way, let's do both.
All right. Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out some of my other episodes. You'll see one or two suggested episodes on the screen now.